If Murray supported the show, I'd be less sick of podcasts.
The Blubbity Blah.
Sending out good vibes.
Good vibes. Underneath breaths of deep gratitude and prayers for guidance and protection. And put on a didgeridoo and shamanic drumming track. Shivers or vibrations and stuff like that.
Okay, guys, welcome back to the Guy America Show. Coming at you late this week with Keith Thompson, the UFO Paradox, back to UFOs. Wasn't there a big long subtitle on that too?
There was a bit of a subtitle. It was the celestial and symbolic reality of unidentified aerial phenomena, which is basically UAPs. So, yeah.
Basically UAPs?
Yeah. Well, it's UAPs. I shortened it to UAPs in the title.
Great.
Yeah. I guess they're calling them that these days, right? Instead of UFOs. Well, both.
Who's winning the election?
Well, I mean, do we want to talk about that even?
We don't need to talk about it. I'm just asking who's winning.
It looks like Trump. It looks like Trump's taking it away. I mean, he's almost at 270 already. So, I mean.
Really?
Yeah, there's some.
Fucking Brandon Powell. He's making it seem like they're stealing it already. And I'm not paying attention. I'm busy hunting.
You're out there hunting. That's why the audio sounds a bit different for this, because Darren's just on his laptop in a little room. And he's hunting with some. With some other folks. We're just about getting ready for our little trip here up to the mountains in a couple of days. But yeah, it's looking pretty interesting. I mean, there's still some sort of some tomfoolery going on a little bit late, like, you know, Obama's come out and said it's going to take days to count it. You know, we might not know right away. And so I think they just called North Carolina and Georgia for Trump. So that's two huge swing states, I guess. So yeah, we're recording this a day late here. So, happens to be on election night. I was trying not to pay attention, but then I couldn't help but
watch. Paying attention at all till we got back to the room here. But it says right now it's 210. 210 Trump to 112 Harris.
Yeah. So, but I'm following the people that are calling it themselves, like. There's a couple of people that are doing their own calling. They're not following the mainstream. Because if you look at like the two different, like CNN and Fox, it's a completely different picture and they're calling it at different times and they're showing it in different ways. It's really kind of funny. Or kind of gross.
New York Times that has it 210 to 112.
Yeah.
Which is, I pulled up because that was the one that we were live following in 2016.
Was it really?
We tanked the show. Yeah, I mean, we've never financially recovered from our decision to back Trump in 2016.
And the reasons were so like mundane back then, right? It's like, hey, we want people to have jobs, and like
it was back then it was drain swamp. Remember, he was just going to be like, talking to the conspiracy culture.
Yeah, fake news. Like,
we're going to release the 9/11 files. We're going to look at vaccines. I mean, how could you not vote for that in 2016? Put yourself in our shoes in mid-2015 and, you know, a politician starts talking about this stuff. How do you not?
Yeah, exactly. But for the regular American people, it was like, look, we want economy and jobs back. I mean, that's what drove the real push.
Yeah. Well, looking back, the economy wasn't so bad in 2015.
Exactly. What I would give to have that, like the inflation gone back to that point.
Oh, man. Anyway, here we are. There might be some background noise. I am in a small cottage. They're calling it a cottage, I think, with there's nine of us here. So
nine of you in a small cottage. So the hunting's been good, eh?
Hunting's been good. I mean, the duck hunting's been slow. Unfortunately, we got... I think we got 3 the first day, 5 the second day, and 8 or 9 today.
That's pretty good, isn't it? I mean,
Nah, you duck hunting with this many guys. I was honestly hoping to have some 30 or 40 or 50 duck, even 50 duck days. But we just, you know, honestly, the migration is still holding off. We had some snow today that put, I think, pushed out the ducks that were on the lake. So we did get to shoot some geese today, though. So I can happily say that everybody here has got a confirmed kill.
Wow.
Yeah, and then that also includes one of the older boys, Runner, from the Mohawk. He's a Mohawk from Quebec. Ganawaga, is that it? I think that's it, right?
I don't know.
Well, we've had Kyle on the show a couple times.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's his nephew. So that's and shot his first deer. So he was pretty excited about that. And then we were out tonight until last light. And we found a big buck, dude, a bigger buck than I've shot personally. So, I mean, this is the thing about taking other people is that I have to sit there and look at a bigger buck than I've shot and not shoot at it.
You have to watch people miss the big buck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but it's always good to know that he's in there so that, you know.
So excuse my ignorance, but buck just means a male deer or like?
Yeah, it was. I'm sure it was a 12 point.
A 12 point male deer. So, okay.
Yeah, if not, it'd be a big 11. It looked bigger than the 11 I shot last year. So, but yeah, unfortunately, a mess. He's only 14. So, you know, that's a young age to be shooting at fucking 12 point bucks. I could understand missing.
Yeah,
he got a goose, so
well, that's good.
Support a goose and a couple of ducks. I mean, we've been doing all right on snow geese. We've got probably 12 snow geese so far this week, and tomorrow morning half of the group is going home tomorrow, and the other half that's hanging over to before we go to Invermere. We found a field today that was full of about 10 or 20,000 snow geese. And we're able to track down the landowner.
Really?
I've got my hunting app that, and I pay for the maps around where I hunt. So that'll tell you who it's like coalesced with the landowner maps. So you can see who owns stuff. And I was able to track down Buddy's number through. I found a obscure link because he's the head coach of a small farming village. I'm not going to name it just because there's no point around here. And it turns out he's the head coach of the hockey team. So his email and phone number were on this weird website. And I got a hold of him. He said we could hunt it. So we'll be out there at 4 a.m. And it's great because it's full of hay bales, probably wheat bales, not hay bales, so straw bales. So we're going to go blind into the straw bales and cover all our blinds of straw tomorrow around 5:30 in the morning and wait for first shot at 6. We painted all of our goose decoys white. So we have like 30 goose decoys to put out there now. And then we have a bunch of other white pails and stuff from Jesse's restaurant. So we'll probably have 50 or 60 white decoys out there. We're going to blind into the hay bales and hope that we can get 10,000 geese to come and land on us. Snow geese tomorrow.
You don't really know like that. You don't really know that's like a hot part of the field. You're just creating that yourself in the morning.
Well, right? What it is they're patterning there. So we know that I know for sure that they're always roosting at the lake that we're hunting. And, they feed during the day at a few fields around the lake. And I came down hunting this week saying it'd be cool if I could get to know some landowners down there. Because the ones around my house, I tried talking to them about hunting fields and they're all like taken. You know, it's just too busy over there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And I'm not new. I'm new. So I don't, you know, if I went some there for a while and you get to know people, then maybe you could get in there ahead of an outfitter or something like that.
Because it seems like there was an outfitter hanging out near me here, a whole bunch of them from like a whole like five or six trucks. I guess they were probably doing that around here, right? They go to because they must have, because you can only have like, or apparently landowners only have like one group of people hunting per day, I guess, on the thing, right? Like you can't have a whole bunch of different groups doing it, right? For the most part.
No, unless you're at the same time. No, yeah. That'd be trouble. So
unless you have massive property that you can say you guys stay on the north end or whatever or something like that. But
yeah, well then you're contending for geese. I mean the geese do land in patches. So we'll be out in the field all morning tomorrow, fucking try and shoot some geese. And this is pretty exciting because we know, like we said, we know the geese are there, the geese are flying around. Lots of geese. While we've been hunting ducks, we've been seeing lots and lots and lots of geese. And snow geese are the ones you can, they're the ones that you shoot lots of. The daily limit on snow geese is 50.
50?
So, yeah, so if everyone got their limit tomorrow, it would be 300 snow geese.
What?
Yeah. There's 8 that the boys are probably breasting out right now that we did today, but we cooked up goose and duck last night, and it was everybody's favorite.
Wow, you're just hunting and eating it right there.
Yeah, we ate the deer heart last night and its tenderloins.
Wow. So the guys are learning to how to make it all too and to dress it all. And
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I was going to bring the guys in here, but maybe it's better if we just do that on a wrap-up show later, you know?
Yeah, yeah, let's do that. Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, it's super busy around here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we do have to mention that you have a couple notes. And, of course, Jim Davis, shout out to Jim Davis, who is a big duck and goose hunter. I mean, we constantly go back and forth on Facebook about our current duck hunting.
Wow.
Things. He's always sending me pictures of him and his nephew or grandson. I can't remember now. Sorry, Jim. But he's hunting with young boys out there. He's teaching the next generation how to hunt. So, synchro. I'm duck hunting now, Jim. Goose hunting tomorrow. I'll send some.
Thanks for the donation, Noble Jim. Another steady 100 or 1080 per month.
Yeah.
So I've got a note here from Hilda about the show, and she says she's going to be sending in value for value. Let me just pull up my email here. Hey, guys, I love your show and the range of topics that you cover, and your pre-show banter is actually soothing. Keep up the good work in helping folks become aware and awake. A value for value donation is on its way to you. Warmest regards, Hilda. So thank you, Hilda. Looking forward to seeing that. And we appreciate the feedback, especially about the banter, because you can always skip this. There's all these lazy ramblings at the beginning where we kind of do all our stuff and the only sort of ads we have is our own stuff that we're doing. Keep everybody up to date and get listeners involved a little bit. But otherwise, you can just click forward to the timestamp in the show notes to the actual interview, which is an incredible interview, too, with Keith Thompson. It's a great show about the UFOs.
It is a fun one.
So this one's from it came in the mail. It's a new book called Under Oblara from M. Andrew Jones. And he's got this, like, his No Agenda Night seal on the envelopes. It's very creative and cool. Hey, boys, here's my newest book, and I also gave you credit in my newest newsletter. Huzzah for mea culpas. Keep up the good work, and thank you for your courage. Love and light, M. Andrew Jones. P.S., you're on the newsletter list. Wahaha. Jeez, I don't think I've seen the newsletter.
I have also not got any newsletters.
I'll look it up. And then he sent a note. So this is like, it had to get resent to us. But here's, I'm going to read this because I feel like I should read this. It's about his books here. Hello, friends and neighbors. Summer is here. And what better way to spend a day at the beach than reading the latest, greatest epic high fantasy. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Book 2 of the Chimera cycle, Under Oblara, is now available, clocking in at a hefty 160,000 words. This chunky boy took over 7 years to produce and continues the adventure of Kriegel Berduvante as he tracks the thief Humbert through the wilds of the North. There's much derring do adventure, calamity, and victory to behold. Get your copy today. The new book wasn't the end of my adventures over these intervening months. I've also been on two podcasts. The first was Extremely Live with Micah Rock and Roll. That's right. The man behind OrangeFlavor.fun had me on to talk about metal. So the listeners of the show might know metal. For those of you who have not heard it, you can find it under the audio tab of my website. Simply type mandrewjones.com/audio into your favorite web browser and select the show from a growing list. The second podcast was Sewer Chat with Nick the Rat, where he and the dark sewer scientists kept me trapped for nearly 4 hours. Thank you to those who noticed that I blinked twice. While you're under the audio tab, check out the most excellent audio version of my novella, Metal, produced by Graham Dunlop and Darren Grimes. Indeed, the men behind everyone's favorite Canadian paranormal podcast, Grimerica, turned my coming-of-age dark comedy into an audiobook. And they did a most excellent job. They also have an impressive and growing number of esoteric audiobooks, which you can find at adultbrain.ca. Yet, I'm the only fiction they've ever recorded. Well, not now. That has changed dramatically since long ago. Kudos for that, you beautiful bastards. Last but not least, I want to assure my adoring fans, yes, the zombie book is in the works, and it is also the inspiration for this issue's writing prompt. Assume you are a survivor in a burning world in the aftermath of the initial outbreak. What do you aim to save, and what do you feed to the fires of time? What would you look to restore, and what would you happily do without? Would you rebuild old electronics or help reestablish the internet? Or would you trade curious cooking utensils and obscure ethnic recipes among the other survivors? Would you collect Charlie Blackmon's baseball cards and do puzzles by candlelight, all while doing a lucrative trade in clean Yahtzee sheets? Or would you lament to the end of taxes and build a collection of elementary school textbooks? Maybe you'd collect seeds and work to establish secret gardens among the abandoned sections of city. Maybe you'd traffic in the old General Motors parts. What role would you delight to play in the new order of things? Get specific and detailed. Well, there it is, people. Issue number 2 of the M. Andrew Jones newsletter. If you wish to find more of my work, visit mandrewjones.com. Most sincerely, and thank you for your courage. Baron of Americans, Mountain, Viscount of the Very Fine People. And then there's a sales coupon here that you can, I'm sure you can get it from his website too, just book prices and stuff like that.
Right on. Well, there you have it, guys. We'll be back next week with a back from CAC.
And a donation of $33.33 USD.
That's like 300 Canadian these
days. Yeah, thank you for that. Noble, Andrew.
Become a noble. Grimerica.ca.
He's becoming a lord. He's a knight of the No Agenda Roundtable, obviously. And he's becoming a lord of Grimerica.
Sounds better than night to me. So why don't you become a Lord of Grimerica? Sign up for a monthly or make a one-time donation today at grimerica.ca/support, guys. Did you do the bio? Yeah, that was the bio, right?
Oh, no, I didn't do the bio. No, I will do the bio quickly. It is Keith Thompson. He's an author, independent journalist, talk radio host, former TV talk show host, and former U.S. Senate staff member. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Esquire, San Francisco Chronicle, Idaho Statesman, and the Pacific Sun. The author of Angels and Aliens and Leaving the Left, and now The UFO Paradox, The Celestial and Symbolic Reality of UAPs. Go to thompsonatlarge.com. And I also included a link to innertraditions.com. And he's got an audiobook on about this book, which is great too. So if people are into UFO books, check out his audiobook. It's awesome.
All right, guys, enjoy the chat. The one and only Keith Thompson. We'll be right back.
All right. Keith Thompson, welcome to Crimerica. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation. We've just been chatting a bit before we went on, and we didn't go too far. So let's continue. Yeah, yeah. Let's continue with the good vibe.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, we've done a lot of shows on UFOs. I can't believe we haven't like had you on before. But I mean, every once in a while, like the title of your book there, The UFO Paradox, The Celestial and Symbolic World of Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. Like it just tweaked me a little bit. I mean, Darren booked the show, but I was like, this sounds like it's going to be interesting because, you know, the UFOs can get kind of, you know, I kind of lost a bit of interest since the government started talking about it. But yeah, your book was, I listened to a few of the chapters today and it's pretty interesting. So looking forward to chatting with you about it.
Good. Good. I'm happy to, you know, the big subject right now is disclosure. What does disclosure mean? And I get asked by hosts, they'll say, is your book about disclosure? And I say with a certain irony, I said, the entire book is about disclosure.
Right.
Namely, I try to disclose the entire phenomenon. And yeah. They say, yeah, but do you cover the government disclosure? I say, well, not primarily, but I'm happy to talk about it. Next week, there's going to be another hearing in Washington, a sort of another congressional hearing, which I think is probably going to be closer to a circus because it's going to be limited to half a day. And I don't even see how they can begin to penetrate this subject and it happened, but we'll see.
Yeah. Do you have a hard time keeping up on the that side of it, the government side of it, the political stuff? Because I can't even like I've lost track completely over the last few years.
Well, there I was commenting the other day to somebody. I said I noticed that there's a style of speaking, especially on X, formerly Twitter, the community of UFO UAP observers on X.
But is that UFOX then?
UFO.
Yeah, UFOX. And so and I'm not a real I observe that community, but I don't comment much. Anyway, I did post something the other day along the lines. I said, I'm simply struck by the number of people who say they are in touch with an amazing disclosure, but they are not in a position to reveal it at this time. I thought you're announcing a disclosure that you can't reveal. So there's a huge amount of bait. I don't know if it's so much switch, but there's a baiting. I don't know how much of it is in good faith, how much of it is to get people to get, you know, to pay to watch certain podcasts, you know, come behind the paywall. I don't know. The disclosure part of the whole thing is, you know, the field of UFO studies has been saying for 8 decades now, any day now, the lid on the government cover-up is going to blow sky high.
Yeah.
And after a while, it's a little bit like the famous stage play, Waiting for Godot. Godot never shows up. That's the whole premise of the play. Everybody's waiting for this man who never shows up, and that's the absurd joke. I you know, I'd love to think that this Air Force or Army intelligence officer named David Grush is correct. He says he's talked with people who tell him that there is or crashed, recovered saucers and biological material being held by the aerospace companies, McDonnell Douglas or Lockheed Martin. Fine. Publish the locations. Open the hangars. Let's see what they've got. But until that happens, I'm just kind of like, this doesn't quite feel like it's going to happen.
Right. But having said that, it's changed a lot since the 90s. Like when I was into it in the early 90s, mid 90s, we were talking about disclosure too. Greer had his whole thing in 2001. You know, we were excited about it, but now it really is like UFOX is an unbelievable platform and community with so many new people involved in the field, you know, and whether it's, and I don't really, you know, I don't really, it's all with a grain of salt for me too, but you know, you do mention in your book too, that memo from 2021, I think it was June, 2021, like that could be considered disclosure. I mean, that was like some people said, the first time they actually admitted these unknowns. So, I mean, in some ways you could just say like disclosure has happened. It's just not fully developed yet.
Well, what I think has happened too, is the famous New York Times article of 2017, which disclosed the Pentagon secret task force, that Luis Elizondo. I see your cat there.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
For those who are listening, I'm watching the cat crawl across the desk. I don't have a cat myself, but I love these animals. So Lou Elizondo was revealed to be the the guy who was running a secret UFO desk, which was remarkable because the government had been saying for decades that there's nothing going on here. You people can go back to your little lives. We're in charge of the skies, and there's nothing in the sky that doesn't belong here. So Elizondo came forward. He's out with a new book called Imminent, which crept up on the New York Times list. And I'm a big fan of any book that does well in this field, yeah. having done a book of my own. But I have to say, Elizondo this week was, you know, there was a video showed of him giving a presentation about the UFO topic, and he identified a sighting through a window. He said, this is a photograph that we were able to take. And it was revealed in the process of the seminar that it was a reflection of the lamp in the room.
No way. That's
I'm not kidding.
It looks like a mothership.
It was the mothership up on the ceiling of the room. And I kind of thought, that's a rookie mistake. If you are the former head of the Pentagon Task Force out with this big book, it's almost as if I sometimes get a little paranoid. I'm not inclined to the paranoid scenarios, but I sometimes think maybe the government is putting Elizondo out there to make a fool of him.
Yeah,
so that he will not reveal anything and
make a fool of the whole everything. Yeah,
further blanket the subject with ridicule and scorn. And that could be. I don't think there's a hardcore. I say my own view is this is just my gut. What the government is hiding is that they don't know what this is. I don't believe they're hiding a crash saucer. I mean, it could be. So it's an empirical claim. If they've got crash saucers, supposedly 12 of them, or recovered, some of them in pristine shape, which is kind of remarkable. Do the aliens just leave these ships? Are they traded? I mean, what kind of a situation is it that there would be fully intact craft? Anyway, that's one thing. But I think mostly what the government is not admitting is that these events, these what appear to be craft, conducting these amazing acrobatics, these maneuvers, incredible speeds, trajectories, right angle turns, turning on a dime, and then disappearing like you turn a TV set off. This is something that tells us we don't understand time and space very well.
And go ahead, Darren.
I think that's part of what this phenomenon is teaching us, that it's trying to, I call it a call from the cosmos. The phenomenon is calling on us, if you will, in the name of the cosmos, to expand our maps, to get a bigger picture of reality, to begin to deal with phenomena that is both material, that is to say physical, and psychic at the same time, involving these synchronicities, which bring in the paranormal. I'm a big fan of the paranormal dimension, by which I simply mean I think that there is a paranormal dimension to this phenomenon.
Yeah.
That's a problematic claim because mainstream science doesn't like to talk about the paranormal anyway. But you know, at some point when a phenomenon consistently reveals itself to have what appear to be paranormal dimensions, and those phenomena don't appear on our maps, then it's up to us to expand our maps. We've done that before. We did it when Galileo made the mistake of saying, wait a minute, the Earth orbits the sun, not the other way around. And the Vatican knocked on his door and said, we want you to stop saying that. We've decided that doesn't work that way. The sun orbits the Earth. And he said, well, you can look through my telescope, this device I've got. They said, no, we won't look through your telescope. So they were so committed to their dogma about the heavenly bodies, they literally refuse to look through the telescope. And I think that's where, you know, our science and society have got to be willing to take this phenomenon seriously and grapple with it.
I'm not convinced that Galileo was wrong. I'm not that Galileo was correct.
Okay, so make the case.
Well, I don't know that I can make the case, but I definitely have been following the work of Simon Schack, who seems to be doing a pretty good job of making the case, including making a working model that I can set to any date in his. At the very least, his model matches the current model that we're running under right now, with the difference being that his model puts the Earth at the center of a binary system between Mars and the sun. And he thinks that that's a unique thing. But so originally the Tychos Brahe.
Yes, yes, I know what you mean. Well, I will tell you, I'm not familiar with the evidence you're talking about, so I'm really open to it. And I'm not even here, so I'll even concede. The point I want to make, though, about Galileo is that at least he did some empirical work. He had his telescope. He had his computations. He reached a conclusion which the church, for dogmatic reasons, said, you're not allowed to say that. So that's my point. When any body, whether it's government or science, says, for example, with the COVID situation, I don't want to go deeply into that, but we now know that a whole lot of what we were told about COVID was not based on science.
Exactly.
Stand 6 feet apart in stores. There was no science in that. That might be common sense, but there were no studies. And as far as the masks are concerned, so, you know, when people talk about the scientific consensus, I go, oh, no, you're not talking about science. Science doesn't involve consensus.
Science not only does it not involve consensus, arguably every single breakthrough in the history of science has been made by an outlier who was at first a heretic.
Including a man named Tesla. And Wilhelm Reich. I mean, there are many heretics. I'm in favor of heresy. This phenomenon is a heretical phenomenon. That's what I love about it. I'm not saying I need for it to remain heretical, but I'm interested in when there's evidence for a phenomenon, including the paranormal in general. Most good many honest materialist scientists will admit that there is a signal, such as telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition. They'll admit it privately, but they don't want to talk about it publicly. They won't get their funding. They'll lose their grants. If they don't have tenure, you don't want to come out with interest in UFOs and the paranormal. So I don't have tenure to lose or to gain.
Your book made me think of that, actually, about the fight of the skeptics they were pushing back about 10 years ago, you know, like the kind of the skeptic guide to the universe and all that stuff. And then, you know, I think they've kind of lost. And your book made me think that the UFOs have played a big part of this last 5-6 years of this battle, I think, has started to really tip the scales. And I loved how you put all that paranormal stuff into the book, because it really also made me think that, like, if you would have told me 10 years ago or even 20 years ago that, hey, maybe it's angels and demons, or maybe it's all this other stuff as well. You know, I would have said, no, there's no way. But now I'm actually to the point where I can almost accept that I don't have a clue what it is, but it could be spiritual, completely spiritual in nature, that's manifesting in some some other physical way. You know, like, should we even be making contact with anything? I mean, that's where I'm at right now, is like, whether it's a daemon helping you out, or whether it's a demon that you're making contact with, or ETs, or, you know, a deity or angels, like, should we be messing around with anything? And I think the government, and I also agree with what you say about they don't know enough about it. I think that the truth is so complex and so maybe scary to us that they can't even begin to tell us. They don't even know. I think that a small group knows, but I think they played around with the occult in the 30s and 40s enough to know that they can make contact with things, and the whole world is way more complex. Our reality is way more complex than can be explained to us properly.
Well, there is I call it a rumor. I'm trying to think of the name of the group. There is in the Pentagon, according to people who track these sort of thing, there's I think it's called the Collins Group.
Collins Elite.
Yeah, the Collins Elite. And so what apparently they are, it's a group of officers in the Pentagon who've been tracking the UFO phenomenon for a long time, and whose view is evangelical, it's a Christian evangelical view that this is a demonic phenomenon. So they do not want us to be investigating. Now, I haven't gone deeply into that subject, into that particular claim, but it's quite plausible that that's part of the pushback inside the Pentagon and the military establishment, that there's a strong belief that these are forces that are that don't mean us well, and we should not be investigating them casually.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And I mean, maybe they do. And maybe some do mean well, like, but how do you know? Right. I mean, when we look back at the Damon, no you way. Mentioned the Damons in your book, the most famous people in our history have had a spiritual voice, a Damon, something whispering in their head. And I mean, it's
Socrates.
Yeah.
Socrates, famous is Daimon. He consulted with his daimon all of the time. In fact, when he was convicted of teaching falsehoods to the youth, subverting the youth of Athens, and was sentenced to death, Plato said, "Well, you're gonna fight the sentence, aren't you?" He said, "No, why not?" And my daimon says, "It's not necessary. I've made my point." Well, Plato understood what he was saying, but yeah, you're right. Spiritual forces of this kind have been part of the human. Every tradition in the Islamic tradition are known as the jinn, J-I-N-N. I mean, you can go sacred traditions throughout the world have these kind of intermediaries. So that's a very fruitful way to look at it.
Yeah,
I mean, throughout history, I mean, there's been that sort of angels and demons or this or that, but there's been that sort of spiritual entity all along. The Indians have the star people. The feather Indians, I mean, not the dots. I don't know what they have with the Vimanas, and I don't know what else. You know, that's the turtle one, isn't it? The turtles stacked on turtles all the way down.
Right, turtle and the Vimanas, you're right. The Vedic tradition in India has UFO-type stuff. So what we know is this phenomenon did not get started in 1947. The modern UFO era did. You could say, with Kenneth Arnold's sighting over Mount Rainier. But even that is that's an interesting sighting. The one where the phrase flying saucer became part of the lexicon. June 1947, private pilot named Kenneth Arnold flying over Mount Rainier looking for a crashed airplane. He saw 9 objects flying in formation at rapid speed, at a certain altitude. He was a very talented pilot, so he was able to clock how fast they were going. And he said they were skipping like saucers would skip over water. And then the news media picked that up and said, Boise, Idaho man reports flying saucers. So people began to see flying saucers. But what I report in the book in revisiting that case is that after Kenneth Arnold died, by the way, his life was not a comfortable life after he was known as the flying saucer guy. He was... suddenly, you know, he was subject to ridicule, jokes, national TV, the guy who saw the flying saucers. Well, there was an aspect of this story he didn't come forward with precisely because of the ridicule. And it is this. His daughter, Kim Arnold, reported after her father passed away. She said, "My dad was always, always confused and did not know what to make of the fact that people thought that he was reporting high-tech nuts and bolts craft. That is not what he saw. He saw the way they moved was like saucers, but he said they appeared to be they were translucent,
blue,
colorful, beaming light objects that appeared to be breathing and to move with the rhythm," he said, "of the human heart," which is whoa. That is a very different take. If that had been reported in the early days, he probably would have been even more of a national joke.
Maybe we wouldn't have seen so many flying saucers since then.
Yeah, the flying saucers are sort of conventional. He also said, you know, Kim, I think these phenomena are whatever I saw. It seemed to be not from another place, but from another dimension. It seemed to be from where he felt he had a deep intuition that these aerial craft were from where we go after this world. They were from the land, you know, where we go after we die.
Yeah.
So again, that's a metaphysical or spiritual interpretation rather than an extraterrestrial. One more thing. When he went home that day to Boise, landed his plane and drove to his home, the family had in their home for the first time and for a continuing period, orbs of light. In their home, balls of light moving, you know, red, blue, green, which are a common occurrence, you know, in UFO sighting, orbs of light. Well, okay, whatever he saw that day in Mount Rainier, he brought it home with him. So what it was not necessarily just a geographic. It appeared to be in space, in time and space. They appeared to be objects, but something happened in his own home.
The Hitchhiker Effect, way back then. You know, that's only been getting some airplay after the Skinwalker investigations.
Well, that's it. Exactly. I use the phrase Hitchhiker phenomenon because the Skinwalker. I didn't go to Skinwalker. You know, funny. I thought of trying to go to Skinwalker Ranch. I tried to finagle an invitation when I was doing the book. I thought, okay, I'm going to take this seriously. But you know, the more I read about the events at Skinwalker, I thought, I don't think I want to go.
No, exactly.
Potential. A couple of people, especially the blue orbs, the orbs that are colored blue, there are a couple of cases where they have interacted with people and caused severe health problems. So I thought, maybe I don't want to be a sightseer at Skinwalker Ranch.
Yeah, probably a smart move. That's what I mean. That's kind of where I'm at the point where I just don't want to play around with anything anymore.
Well, the guy who owned it, Robert Bigelow, as you know, the aerospace titan from where is it?
BASS.
Yes, and he from Nevada, from Las Vegas, exactly. I met him at a conference, and I can't claim to have had a lot of interaction with him, but I did say, Bob, I'm thinking of going for my book to. He no longer owns Skinwalker Ranch; he'd already sold it, but he had been there, and he had his own experiences, and he also had hitchhiker phenomena come home to his house, lights in the house, and other things he didn't even want to talk about. I said, would you recommend that I go? I mean, if I'm thinking of going, what would be your advice? He said, he just looked at me. He said, Keith, don't go unless you're willing to have something come home with you. Wow. He didn't say it would, but he said, don't, if you go, be willing, be prepared that it might have something, that it might come home with you. He also commented that they learned at Skinwalker Ranch that if you came onto the property with respect and a kind of reverence for the phenomena that would appear, these tall, two-legged wolf figures. I mean, you name it. If you came onto the property with respect and a learner's attitude, you tended not to have any trouble. It was the ones who came onto the property from the military with their clipboards and with a strong, rational mindset that they were going to figure this out. They're the ones who tended to have the mind-blowing, shocking encounters,
which is very counterintuitive, because sometimes you'd think that they wouldn't want those skeptical people to have those experiences. You know, that would be saved for the people that are open-minded. But
There is a legend, and it's a bona fide legend that the Skinwalker Ranch is on property that was the site of an Indian Native American curse. I don't know the name of the tribes, but it was heavy duty stuff. If you dismiss all that kind of stuff, you go, well, that's irrelevant. I don't dismiss all that stuff, quote, all that stuff. I think it's a form of nature that we have not explained yet. So I don't play around with spells and I don't cast them. But yeah, so I think it's a burial ground. There was a lot of negative history associated with that land. So it's entirely plausible to me that there's something still alive and active there.
And a lot of real evidence of electromagnetic interference and that kind of stuff there too, which makes you wonder what's underground around that area, or is that like what came first, you know, the curse or the electromagnetic fluctuations or whatever?
Or are they related? Is the curse able to intermit with our spectrum? So it's all something. I completely come down on the side though. If I go to a cemetery, and we all have a certain common sense attitude that says come with respect, I'm not suggesting that if I go for a walk in a cemetery, I'm afraid I'm going to meet poltergeists. But just from common etiquette, if you walk through a cemetery, you show respect because it is the resting place. There may be other reasons to show respect as well.
So by that Skinwalker Ranch example, how do you feel about like the stuff Stephen Greer? No. Is it Stephen
Greer? Yeah.
So Stephen Greer and these guys are doing where like Graham used to do, where they go out and they try and summon aliens.
That's called Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. And there's a whole Close Encounters of the First, Second, Third, Fourth, and Fifth. Well, the fifth kind, yeah, Stephen Greer sort of pioneered in this phenomenon of taking people out into nature, into settings, and practicing meditation. He's a big believer in the consciousness component of this phenomenon. I've met him only once. I know he's a controversial figure. Some people speak highly of him, some people not so highly. Because he's been in the field a long time and he's made a lot
on this show. Some people on this show speak highly of him and some people on this show speak less highly of him.
Yeah, there's less highly. Exactly. And he's made a lot of strong statements and claims. And in any case, he took people, takes people out or has taken them out, and people report seeing stuff. There's one case, I can't take a stand on it, but there's one case in which he is accused of having hired a private airplane to, in one of these outings, to drop flares that would meet the criteria that he was trying to get across. So the idea is he charged Larson. I'm not claiming this is true. I am simply claiming it's true that he was accused of having done that. He denied it. And I know people apart from Greer who have done the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind, gone out and summoned lights and what they consider craft. I've never had the experience. I've never gone out with a group, but it is a pretty solid side of this phenomenon.
Oh yeah, I agree. I mean, there's multiple groups too. There's not just his. There's ET Let's Talk is another group. We had a guy on from that many year, 8 or 9 years ago, probably. And then the CE5s all over the place. And they're, I mean, we got results. I went out many times and got results. I mean, we saw stuff, we communicated with stuff, but you know, even after all that, even though ET is sort of like the, you know, the Occam's razor of that movement, because you're asking for ET, you're doing the meditations, you're following the protocols and you see stuff. So, you know, it sort of makes sense that it's ET, but I'm not even there anymore with that. I don't know what it is. It could be anything. You know,
In terms of where the knowledge ends up, the skeptics will say, well, good, take me out. Let me see it. So a skeptic goes out, doesn't see it. So it's not something that is easily or predictably replicated.
Exactly.
And that is what makes this phenomenon not easy to study scientifically, and it's what allows for skepticism to turn into debunking. I make a distinction between the two. I consider myself a skeptic. Meaning if somebody presents a claim, I'm going to say, oh, okay, how would I verify that? How did you verify it? You verified it that way. Would that same information be available to me if I conduct the same experiment you did? Will I have the same results? That's skepticism. It's not, rather than taking it on face value. The debunker is a different kind of person, both in the UFO field and in paranormal phenomena. They're the ones who caustically just dismiss claims. And they're generally brought on to these TV shows like Oprah, where they start the first half hour is with the witnesses and they're like, you know, abduction witnesses. And maybe John Mack, the late Harvard psychiatrist, would appear as their champion. And then in the last part of the show, Oprah or the host would bring out a so-called skeptic, but who would really be a debunker and would then sort of whip the audience into mocking and ridicule. Well, whatever we want to say about the scientific method, ridicule is not part of it. So when you go to that level, it's an unfortunate, it's a sad part of our tribal resistance to new knowledge.
What's your thought now, especially that we found all these planets now in the habitable zones, like the solar system or the universe is getting bigger and bigger every couple of months. I mean, what's your thought now on the ETH in general?
You know, it could be extraterrestrial. I tend to be fairly cautious. It's consistent with an extraterrestrial hypothesis. There are a lot of unanswered questions about how they would get here, what the way they would. As you know, Jacques Vallée, the researcher who was close to J. Allen Hynek and one of the lead researchers in the field, actually has abandoned the ET hypothesis and really believes this is a form of intelligence that is pointing beyond time and space as we know it. It's another reality, not necessarily coming from other galaxies, but from other dimensions that may be right here, right now, in the same sense that paranormal phenomena are right here, right now. So I can't, you know, I don't try to set out to prove that it is extraterrestrial. If David Grush is correct about recovered craft that are in the possession of the aerospace companies, well, we're going to find out on November 19th. That is the date that Congress, I don't know if it's the House or the Senate, but the next congressional hearing with the few members of Congress who take this seriously enough to even show up. I don't know who the speakers are going to be, but we'll see what they produce. I mean, it's been a year and a half now since David Grush delivered to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community what he said are the dates and locations and names of people who are part of the back engineering of recovered spacecraft. I don't know if the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community will be at this. He may not be, but we will see. We'll see if there's any, Daniel Sheehan. He was just out on one of the podcasts describing that there's a certain latitude and longitude in somewhere in the Southern Hemisphere. There's a base underwater, a UFO base. Well, okay, you've got the latitude and longitude. Great. Maybe Robert Bigelow, the billionaire, will fund a big expedition. I would love to be part of it myself, or at least I would love to see it happen. If it's an empirical claim, if you've got the location, let's bring it on.
Yeah, it's. I got a feeling it could be all of the above or both too. Like Nick Oracle says in the chat here, Eric P. Anthony, who was a previous guest on our show, he writes some science fiction books too. He says that the aliens we are familiar with are able to come into our dimension by way of frequency adaptation. Our frequency is slower and theirs is higher. So I like those kind of theories.
Ours is more dense, maybe. I mean, we're in the material, the more dense realm. I think there's something to that. I think that people say, what's going on in the abductions? These are real experiences. People are having real interactions with the parallels, the descriptions. They're not all contagious. You know, they're not all listening to each other's stories. But they're very hard to examine. There's a Netflix series on right now. It's about a particular case that Bud Hopkins studied, the Manhattan alien abduction.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a three-part. I watched it last night. It deals with all of the complexities of an abduction case. The more deeply you penetrate into it, the more the trickster phenomenon of the trickster dimension of the phenomenon makes itself known. Most people who have had abductions, who go public, don't do very well because of the amount of ridicule and derision they get. I'm often asked as a supposed expert, if should I come forward, Keith, and tell anybody about my experience? My answer is yes, you should tell somebody, but don't tell everybody. Don't necessarily go on a podcast and talk about the way Whitley Strieber did 30, 40 years ago. I have a great respect for Whitley Strieber, who wrote the best-selling book Communion, but his life has not been easy by being that abduction guy. He has a hard time getting book contracts now as an author, but I give him credit. He was willing to pay the price of just telling the truth as he saw it.
Yeah. You know, you've been at this since school, like when you're a kid, right?
Yeah, that's how I got into this. I was 12 years old. In the sixth grade, it was my turn to give a current events report. And
all the way back. So I'm interested in how your view has changed over the years. It's probably a pretty basic question you get all the time, but especially.
I do get it. Let me just tell you one part of this, the current events. I gave a report to the class about a Michigan sighting. And when it was all over, my teacher came up, as she often did, stood next to the person giving the current events report, which in this case was me. She said, Keith, that was a great report. She said, what I think we could learn from what Keith told us today about this sighting in Michigan is to keep an open mind and ask relevant questions. And I can still remember the sense of affirmation that gave me as a kid who had given a report to his class, and to have the teacher say, what Keith is telling us is to keep an open mind and ask relevant questions. And then she turned to me and said, Mr. Thompson, in the way teachers often do, you have the makings of a scientist or a journalist or maybe even a detective. Follow the clues wherever they lead.
Wow.
And, you know, again, as life advice, I could have gotten a teacher who said, well, Mr. Thompson, of course, you must agree this is very likely a ridiculous topic and there's probably nothing going on here, but you've done a good job anyway. Well, that would have been one way to handle it. And she didn't take a stand on it herself. The point is that follow the evidence wherever you lead goes into what you've just asked me. How has my view changed? As I continue to pay attention, I can't say that on that day in 12 years old, sixth grade, that I became a UFO investigator, that I was going to figure it out. But I did continue to pay attention. And I began to read the books. I followed the cases, eventually wrote this book. The point I want to make is that by following the evidence wherever it leads is what got me, gave me the permission to follow the paranormal dimension of it. It's a part of the phenomenon that many ET researchers don't like because it sort of makes it far more complicated than a strict, just material craft coming from outer space. But, you know, my approach is, well, I don't want to take a stand on trying to prove a particular hypothesis. The paranormal parts of it, the sense in which UFO witnesses end up having telepathic experiences, spiritual experiences that they'd never had before. This phenomenon is connected with the psyche in some way, even if it's physical. It can be both. So that's how my view has changed, by just being willing to follow the evidence wherever it leads. I didn't grow up in a family that, quote, believed in the paranormal. We didn't have seances in our home. We didn't study psychic phenomena, but I was never given any reason to believe that it was off limits. And so my approach is when there's data and there's evidence for something, even if it doesn't make sense, follow it. That's my instinct.
I love it. So what was I going to say about that? Darren, do you have any questions at all?
Have you ever given any thought to, or have you ever come across any evidence of them being more local than, or even interdimensional, like, you know, coming out of the ocean or from the moon?
They very, very well could be interdimensional. In fact, they could be largely aquatic. Think of the amount of this planet that is water, 3/4. And so when Daniel Sheehan says he's located a base underwater, well, they are seen coming in and out of water quite often. As often as we wouldn't know from the phrase unidentified flying object, because that tended to place the phenomenon in the sky. But yeah, water, underwater, some take it into the crypto-terrestrial, you know, Bigfoot. I don't go into that area simply because at some point I have to draw my limits. But I think there's a general theory of the paranormal that would bring in a much wider range. I think we haven't scratched the surface in terms of our knowledge of non-ordinary phenomena.
Yeah, I agree with you. We kind of lost some, we lost some momentum in the early 1900s, you know, after there was so much focus on it in the 1800s. And then, you know, World War One, maybe everything shifted. We lost, you know, and now we're just gaining back that some of that momentum from sort of beating the skeptics over the head with all the evidence over the last 10 or 20 years.
You're right. When the British Society for Psychical Research was studying psychic phenomena in England, Frederick Myers was a great researcher, very skeptical, but very open to phenomena. There was a far, you know, Carl Jung wrote his doctoral dissertation, his medical dissertation on the occult. Yeah. So that would have been, what, 1903, 1904? So, but there was a shift toward hardcore materialism, physicalism, get rid of psychic phenomena. That stuff is outdated. That's metaphysical. We're dealing with physical reality. So we went through a very dark period. I think we're coming out of it now into a larger paradigm where, thanks to phenomena like the near-death phenomenon.
Yes.
That has absolutely gotten a lot of scientific credibility because it, you know, when you've got medical doctors who are talking to patients and the doctor says, well, now that you've come out of the anesthesia, let's discuss the prognosis. And the patient would say something like, well, doctor, I already know the prognosis because I overheard you talking with Dr. Smith in the other building an hour ago. You were eating a tuna fish sandwich, and I see you spilled some on your tie. I saw that you did it. I mean, those kind of things. And the doctor says, well, how are you kidding? How do you know this? Did you get up out of bed? No, I left my body. I died. What? I went to another realm. Well, so one after another. So these doctors, I'm trying to think of one in particular. Well, the author of Life After Life, Raymond Moody, would begin to talk with patients and say, by the way, have you had any of these kind of experiences? And a great number of patients did. So that's a good example of a phenomenon that science has opened far more optimistically to.
Yeah, I would agree. Have you had any experiences yourself, either paranormal or UFO related?
I've not had a UFO experience. I did have my own near-death experience, a near-drowning experience, at a time in my life in my mid-late 20s, off the coast of Hawaii with a bunch of friends. We were body surfing in some waves that were really way, way too strong. And there were signs on the beach, you know, if in doubt, don't go out. But when you're in your mid-20s, it's kind of, it doesn't apply to you. So I got myself taken out by some riptides and was convinced that I had died. I was taken by a huge wave and absolutely crushed to the bottom of the water, to the sand below. And the next thing I realized, I was rising. I thought, oh, I'm rising up out of the water, or from the bottom in the water, but I was actually rising out of the water and experienced myself leaving my body through the back of my head. I'd never heard of out-of-body experiences, never read anything about psychic phenomena up to that point. And I saw my body in the water, which was, well, right then and there, I said, the sense of I, awareness is still intact, but that's not me. Or that is me, but it's not me. And I saw my friends on the shore calling to the body, Keith, Keith, because the body was struggling. And I was beginning the process of leaving this world. I don't know how exactly. I didn't have that moment when, as many near-death people do, when they hear a voice say, it's not your time, must go back. If I was told that, I don't remember. All I remember is I was suddenly finding myself in a cove. I was washed into a cove and my friends were approaching me and they were helping me stand up. And by the way, there were two dolphins that had been accompanying me coming in. So I can't say the dolphins saved my life, but I went from fighting for my life to sensing that I had died. I had an experience that day. I said, oh, dead isn't dead. And here's the key. My friend Mary, who was part of the group that was body surfing, again, we were all in our 20s and just having a vacation together. She was standing on the shore while Keith was drowning. And she was saying to a mutual friend named Moore, why didn't Keith listen? I told him it was dangerous. I told him it wasn't safe. She was anguished and she was speaking just as loud as I am right now. Well, I was 100 or more yards. The Keith body was that far out. And the waves were crushing. So I didn't hear her there. I heard her non-locally. And so I went to Mary and I said, you know, tried to come to Mary and say, Mary, I'm okay. It's all okay. I'm not coming back, but, you know, I'm okay. It's all good. She couldn't hear me. So I thought, oh, well, then I must be dead because I can hear them, but they can't hear me. So the next day, after I survived, after they got me on my feet and talked to me about it, and I was saying things like, I died and came back. But the interesting thing is the near-death phenomenon had not been made famous yet. None of us knew anything about the stages, the tunnel, which I had gone through, the sense of spiritual figures that I interacted with, the sense of seeing dead relatives, which I did, had no expectation of that. So the next day after I'd survived, I said to my friend Mary, could we go for a walk? She said, yeah. And she said, I said, I heard what you, so we went, you know, down the street. I said, I heard what you said yesterday. She said, what do you mean? I said, when you were standing on the shore, why didn't Keith listen? I told him it wasn't safe. I told him it was too dangerous to go out. I can tell you now, I can still see how the blood drained from her face as I told her that. Because we both knew, we had not thought deeply about the nature of consciousness or any of these big questions about life and post-mortem existence and does consciousness survive? But we both knew that I would not have been able to hear her say that in a conventional frame of reference. So we remained close for the rest of her life. And I was with her near the end of her life when she was just a couple days dying from a health malady. So anyway, that was a very profound experience for me. So yes to a near-death experience, but no to a UFO experience.
And also the effect it had that had on you in the long run, you know, the fear of death or the lack of fear of death now. I mean, I feel like that's a very important reason why we got to talk about this stuff and why it needs to, you know, become more of a, you know, a mainstream narrative that you know, we shouldn't be afraid of death, because I feel like we're all like in this weird, like sort of scientific materialistic paradigm where everybody's scared of death. Like that would change, you know, our society so much if we all realized that.
Well, I can say for me that all fear of death did leave that day. I wasn't even aware of it until I began to be around people who were dying, my mother. And I said, oh, I got some information. I saw, what I understood is I read the books of the debunkers. You know, there are a lot of books debunking the near-death experience, trying to say that it's all just brain stuff, loss of oxygen. That might account for some aspects of it, but it doesn't account for the psychic phenomena of being out of the body and experiencing. Oh, by the way, when I was looking at my body, I was with a sense of tranquility, peace, and serenity. I told Mary that day, I said, Mary, I'm fine. I'm not going to be back. I'm not coming back, but I'm fine. It's all good. This is all good. And I've come to see that. Life is hard, but I'm not concerned. I don't know how I'll leave this world, but I'm not afraid of what comes after. I know that I'm confident that the process of leaving my body was the beginning of a process in which consciousness survives. So I don't know what form it survives. There are post-mortem visitations, deathbed visitations, their materializations. I mean, you know, and the near-death experiences, very strong. People come back strongly convinced in the afterlife, in some kind of afterlife, and free of the fear of death. So it is a very liberating thing.
And sometimes with special powers. I mean, not to, you know, that is the only, the best description. I mean, they do have sometimes healing powers or clairvoyance or, you know, some kind of difference. Did you notice any difference in your abilities at all? Or?
For a while, I did seem to, and I did not look for this, but there were times when it felt like I was having electromagnetic interactions with lights. Lights would come on and off, street lights, and my intuitive sense of things was heightened, and my compassion. I'm not always an easygoing person. I can get moments of road rage, but, you know, irritation like the best. But there was some kind of shift in me. That, you know, don't sweat the small stuff, and it's all small stuff in a sense. So I do know that there's one particular person whose name I can't quite recall right now, nor the name of her book. I wish I could. But a near-death person who had a near-death experience who was struck by lightning, Elizabeth Loftus, I think her name was, struck by lightning on a synagogue parking lot and survived. And had very clear psychic gifts. She could predict. She saw things that happened, and she wasn't happy. She didn't want to have precognitions. Many people who do are not really pleased about it. Because it separates you. You know, it's really, it creates the same thing that abductees face. They're like a cognitive minority. They're making a claim about an experience which the rest of society is not willing to concede is possible. Yeah. That's not a good place to be.
Yeah. Darren, do you got a question?
You must have seen that change quite a bit over the last, I mean, however, I'm not going to guess at your age, but you've been interested in the phenomena since you were a child. How much have you seen it change? Is it changing the direction you thought it would? And are you disappointed in how far it's come or encouraged?
By the UFO phenomenon?
Yeah, by the UFO phenomenon specifically.
I'm encouraged by what happened in 2017, the New York Times revelation of the Pentagon Task Force group that showed the government, which had been saying nothing's going on here, was actually studying what was going on here. So we've kind of come out of a pretend game. I don't think, however, it'll be interesting to see what happens in just a few weeks November 19 when the congressional hearing happens. But I think we're on a different road than we have been on. But I don't expect imminent, quote, disclosure. I think this is a long-term venture.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Can you get into that Senate here? Did you say Senate hearing?
It's either Senate or House, and you could look it up and see if you could get in, get a ticket. There are public galleries. You can and there will be seating.
And the tickets are probably hard to get. What was the main thing? What was the main like? What's the details of the main thing?
Well, it's a hearing of a joint subcommittee or a joint meeting of two different House or Senate committees. I'm sorry, I can't be more precise. The reason I'm not is because I understood there was going to be both House and Senate, but either House or Senate hearings are going to be held. I don't know who is going to be on the dais, you know, who will be on the panel. The last time it was Ryan Graves, one of the Air Force pilots around the Tic Tac sighting of 2004,
yeah,
and radar people, and David Grush spoke about his evidence that there are recovered craft. So I would expect that it will be a continuation. What is the latest? How much closer? Is there any new evidence about recovered craft and recovered beings?
Because there was a bit of a kerfuffle. When would that have been? 6 months ago, maybe, when there was sort of some blocking of people in the what was it? People in the aerospace industry seemed to be blocking. So, or there was a few high level guys that were kind of blocking testimony or truth or something like that. It was getting a little bit frustrating there.
The UFO task force is now become the I'm so bad with acronyms. It is the All Domains Anomalies Resolution Office. So what's interesting there, not surprisingly, is they had somebody who was the director of that resolution department who was not sympathetic, was said not to be sympathetic.
Right. That's what it is.
So there's a lot of politics. In fact, even Lou Elizondo, the former task force head, UFO task force head, UAP task force head, who's now out with his book Imminent, some believe that he's representing the very government. He's left the government. He still can't, there's still things he can't say by his own admission because he is under his security clearance still holds. Critics tend to say, oh, that's convenient. He's been trotted out to play a kind of song and dance role here. He's not going to help bring about disclosure. He's part of the cover-up. I'm not saying that myself, but that's the level of suspicion that I think we have to accept has been caused by decades of dishonest. If we had had an honest response from the beginning, it would have been along these lines. We're the government. We see things in our skies that we can't explain. We don't know how to explain them to you. We're monitoring it, but go about your lives in the meantime.
Yeah.
That's not something that the government, which is supposed to have all the answers, especially if you wear medals on your chest. And if you, I mean, every time you
and
see
it, you're responsible for the security of the country. Yeah.
That's it. And you give press conferences in the Pentagon from the Pentagon podium. You're not going to talk about what you don't know. And you're going to say what you can't say. You're going to say that you can't discuss that further because it's security. Things are way overclassified for sure. And I think there's a lot of stuff that is classified simply because it allows us to pretend that it allows us not to admit that we don't know what's going on.
Right, right.
Gun to your head, what do you think is going on?
Yeah, this is a phenomenon that is able to transgress the division between mind and the mental and the physical. Give me an example of what I mean by that. There's a witness whose name was Dennis Sant, S-A-N-T, in the Hudson Valley, New York sightings of the 1990s. He was driving along on a road. He saw out his window. He suddenly had a calling. Look out your window. An urge, a voice. He looked out and saw something like maybe out of Steven Spielberg, okay, a UFO, a craft, a saucer. And as he watched that saucer, as he drove for 20 minutes, he felt that he was going through a life review process, reliving his entire life, very much like what happens in the near-death experience. I know that because I had a life reliving, life review. I felt in my 20 years, I saw in a matter of seconds, it seemed, probably only seconds or a very short period of time, vast amount of reliving primary events of my life with compassion and insight and understanding that seemed to have a spiritual dimension to it. That's what Dennis Sant reported. So what I'm pointing to is he felt this, he felt a voice that said, look out your window. And when he did, he saw the craft, something in the air. And for 20 minutes, as it shimmered and as he watched it, he felt that he went through a complete life review that led to understandings about the nature of things. So what am I getting at? This is a phenomenon that is erasing, that, that shows that the line between the mental and the physical is not firm. So what does that mean in our lives? It says to me that when you're sitting around and you've been thinking about a friend from high school, strangely, and you say, I'm going to call Jim someday. I wonder whatever happened to Jim. And within a day or so, the phone rings and says, hey, Keith, this is Jim from high school. Well, when you begin to have those kinds of experiences, which we all do, we have those moments, paranormal, we see things we're not, we know things we're not supposed to know. I would say that that is a precursor to the, to what goes on in UFO stuff as well. That wow. we're not living in a strictly material universe. Consciousness is non-local.
It might not be material at all.
It might not be material at all. That's a very, you know, Bernardo Kastrup, the philosopher from Europe, has written a good many books on what he calls analytic idealism. He makes a very strong case that there's nothing but consciousness and that the material world is a particularly form, dense form. That what we experience as the material world is a particularly dense form of it. So we may have it entirely backwards. Physicalism, materialism may be true. You know, the hard problem of consciousness. Well, how did the material blind random forces called electrons, atoms, atomic phenomena? How does it suddenly develop self-consciousness? Well, maybe it doesn't. Maybe consciousness is the very ground. Maybe consciousness is all there is. So it's a non sequitur. How does dead matter suddenly become self-aware? Maybe we're asking the wrong question.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything from your book that we didn't get to that you wanted to talk about before we wrap it up?
Well, I deal with that. I deal with in one of the closing chapters, the entangled particle phenomenon. Yeah. Where, you know, photons of light stay in touch across time and space. And so I bring that in, and I bring that in primarily because I think this phenomenon, the UFO phenomenon, is, like I say, it's a call. It's a calling from the rest of reality for humans to play a bigger game and to open to dimensions of reality that don't make sense to us, but are part of the reality we live in.
I love it. Awesome.
Well said. Keith, where can people find all your stuff? Where can they get the book? I know you have some other books too. Do you want to let people know where they can find those? Or if not, that's fine too.
Yeah, I've got a website, which is thompsonatlarge.com. Thompson with a P. And at that website, there are links to Amazon, where the book is available, Barnes & Noble's, but especially at Amazon. It's available by print, ebook, as well as an audiobook. So I've got other stuff I've written at my website. So thompsonatlarge.com, and that's the main place to find me.
Do you have any social media?
I'm on X at Keith Thompson #1, the numeral one. Keith Thompson #1 at Twitter or X. Although I'm more of an observer there than but people can reach me there. If people listen, can find me there, send me a note there. I'd be glad to say hello.
I'm a forced observer. So I'm also not allowed to follow people, so it even makes the observing kind of sketchy. But
yeah, I'm a stalker, I guess you might say. I have to really hold back when I see the any day now the cover up it's going to blow sky high. We're closer than ever. By the way, I think the reason, one reason that's a widespread belief now is that a lot of people are new to the UFO phenomenon. From the 2017 New York Times article. So because in 2017, only what, 7 years ago, that article said, oh, the government has been watching this all along. I think there's a new generation of UFO observers who think, oh, well, we're right on the verge of disclosure. What I'm often the one who has to come in and say, I've been watching this thing for many decades, and the expectation of imminent disclosure ain't nothing new. So I'm kind of the grumpy guy. You kids get off my yard. Get off my lawn.
But having said that, it's really like, it's weird to see them talking about it so openly. I mean, you know, Elon, Joe Rogan, the most popular people on the planet are talking about UFOs. So that's, to me, that's like a huge, and the media has stopped playing the X-Files music in the background. Like there's really been like a sea change in the way it's handled now. So, you know, there's not a lot of ridicule. People can talk about their experiences, not openly in the government yet, but you know, it's coming.
I've been on a lot of podcasts and radio shows since this book came out. And I can tell you, I haven't once heard the X-File music. I thought I would, and I was prepared for it with a good sense of humor, but there's far more openness. So something has shifted. If the phenomenon is observing us, observing it, it must have registered. Okay, the humans are a little more open, but they're still a weird tribe. So I think they're very nervous. I think they're more nervous about us than we are about them. And they see how we behave. If they're watching the presidential campaign, they must be very.
Oh, there we go. I had to pop his cherry.
All we need is Art Bell.
Yeah. Art Bell, wouldn't that be something?
From the high desert in the middle of the night, this is Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah, yeah, there's an icon.
1988.
Is that 88?
Oh, it does go back to the late 80s. Yeah, I was listening to it like Night Shift and Overweighty Foods. Yeah, in the late 80s. Yeah.
Were you overweighty?
No.
Keith, this has been great. Thanks for coming on the show. Come back. Like I said, I'll be in touch and maybe we'll do another podcast here down the road.
I'll be happy to. I've enjoyed this a lot.
Have a great evening. Thanks, man.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
And that was a chat with Keith Thompson, the UFO Paradox. I couldn't put the full title of the book in because they limit you to 100 characters.
Yeah, so I wondered about that.
That's how they, I guess that's probably because that's what YouTube and Facebook do. So anyway.
I'll mention that then. The Celestial and Symbolic World of Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, and the links are in the show notes.
That was a good one. I was excited to get that one going because I knew it would be right up your alley.
So. Yeah, it was good. Good book, too. I recommend it on audio. I believe he narrated it, actually, I think, on audio. So, yeah, check it out on Audible as well.
Absolutely. Big thanks to Keith for coming on the show. Big thanks to you guys for listening. Hey, while you're over there on Audible, grab some of our books, Adult Brain Publishing. If you just type in Adult Brain Publishing into Audible, they'll all pop up. The new one just came out, Atlantis by Ignatius Donnelly.
Ignatius.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
All right. Extra big thanks. If you guys are one of our supporters, one of our nobles here in Grimerica, we've only got a few of them, but we love each and every one of you. You can, of course, become a noble over at grimerica.ca/support today by signing up for a monthly or making a one-time donation. This will be like 673 or 4 episodes we've got out here, you know, all here, all commercial free, if you don't count our begging for money. But if everyone who listened to this show gave us a dollar, we would shut the fuck up. So there's that. America.ca/support. Give us a grand and become a lord or a lady. And you can also send in a note and we'll read it. So check out GrimericaOutlaw.ca for other podcasts, AdultBrain.ca for the audiobooks, Contact at the Cabin for the trips, and I think that's about SpamGram, Graham@GrimErica.com. Other than that, we love you guys. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
The fuel for your worries.